Welcome back to the program. T.S. Eliot once said that we shall not cease from exploration at the end of all of our exploring. We will arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And so it is that in this new century, as we're compelled to interact more with the East, with China, Japan, and India, perhaps it will better enable us to understand our own limitations and see ourselves in a global rather than a provincial context. In so doing, we might also redefine both the importance of history coupled with our ongoing urge to be modern. We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, Patrick Smith. He's the author of the previous book, The Nippon Challenge. He's written for numerous publications, including the International Herald Tribune, The New Yorker, and The Nation. And he's the author of a new book entitled Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Post-Western World. Patrick Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Jeff, and great. Thank you for your interest in the book.
Great to have you here. When you talk about a post-Western world, explain what you mean.
To an extent, I think we Westerners may not be aware of it. The world was ours to shape for a great long while, and my focus begins in the book in the mid-19th century. And what we call the modern was ours, we developed it. It was our idea of progress and what that meant. And in effect, we exported it. And in that century, the East was the... We were the ones to project, and the East were the ones... Easterners were the ones to receive. And the point I want... My starting point in the book is we don't really have too much of an awareness of what it might be like to become modern according to someone else's idea of it.
Uh-huh. Part of what we're seeing and part of what you talk about are the ways in which these cultures in places like Japan and China and India are on the one hand embracing the modern, but then kind of turning it around on its head and incorporating it with their historical cultures.
I don't think I could have put it any better. When what we are calling the modern arrived in Asia, and we can say as a matter of shorthand, I suppose it arrived in Japan before it arrived anywhere else in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, the immediate impulse was to adopt it, embrace it very fulsomely, okay? And what was local, what was traditional was... We might say buried, or we might say erased, or we might say devalued, and there's something correct in all of those terms. But stages developed, and the buried or the devalued, paradoxically, the book is quite stuffed with paradoxes, and this is one of them, eventually became quite treasured. And I think our moment is rather special because it is the point at which Asians are beginning to recognize that they don't have to be Western in all ways in order to be modern. And so you find the Japanese embracing their Japanese-ness, all right? And the Chinese, who are somewhat caught up now in the Westernization process, you find it there too, right? India is quite a special case. It's quite a special country. I think readers will recognize my deep affection for that place and its people. It's always been sitting at some midpoint between East and West, and it's really not entirely one or the other, so it's a somewhat special case.
The notion of incorporating modernity with historical context, though, is not a new one even for us. I mean, if we look at it in this country, perhaps with respect to the arts or with respect to design and various other aspects of culture, there's certainly ample example of how we've done that from time to time.
I think that I don't like the word I'm about to use, but I think that's part of what some of us call the postmodern, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the original modern impulse, okay, coming from the late 19th century and so forth, was the sensation, perhaps the intent, was a certain departure from the past. I mean, you know, history was an imprisoning thing, and the new, the romance of the new, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were much taken with that. And when we exported our notion of the modern, it created that very same impulse among Easterners. It was rather a huge step, to take quite a small example. There are thousands. You know, what did it mean if you were Japanese and you put your kimono aside and wore a Western suit, right? It was something very new. It along with it were countless new sensations, a new idea of living, and so on and so forth. And so I agree with you that there is an impulse now to search back into the past, and I couldn't approve of it more. I value history very much, and I don't think many of us Americans recognize how much is to be found there.
As Asia goes through this process, is what they are turning out something we would consider unmodern, or is it simply a new definition of modern as far as they're concerned?
A very good question. It's the latter, is the very short answer. They are redefining the modern, and it no longer entails this sensation of leaving the past behind that I was just trying to explain. To be modern no longer means to be Western, okay? One can be modern and quite Japanese. My point is that one of the points I want to make on this line is a bit subtle, but it's very interesting, and I think readers might enjoy considering it. There's no erasing the last 150 years, and so I think Asians are beginning to recognize, well, to be Chinese or to be Indian, it's not a matter of going back to museums full of ancient things. What we are made up of is what we, as we began, okay, but we are also made up of the last 150 years of experience interacting with the West, absorbing what the West so powerfully sent our way, et cetera, et cetera. It's a, as I say in the book, it's a rather strong term, but I find it useful, and it was suggested to me by an Indian friend. Asia is, in effect, we can say, miscegenated, okay? Pure Asia is, it's for postcards and museums.
To what extent does immigration policy here, in terms of people from India and China and Japan coming to the West, what impact is that having on us?
I think quite a good one. You know, I am speaking to you and your listeners from the Hudson Valley north of New York. And, you know, there's a considerable Indian population in and around these communities. I think it's having a very positive impact. It's going to complicate life for us, because when we say we Americans, we're going to have to be very careful about what we mean by we, aren't we? And in effect, it's the East coming West. And that's part of what I was trying to get at in the third of my essays. Our notion of we is going to be complicated, but I think in quite a positive way. You know, what I hope it produces is an impulse, as I urge from nearly the first page of the book, to begin to see in a new way, to begin to look out at the world in a new way, and to begin to understand our place in it differently. We've passed out of a certain age, and we're entering another.
If we look back at the end of the 18th, early 19th century, and look at the way Western European influence came here to America, can we learn anything from that experience? Is there anything instructive in that?
I think so. Honestly, I hadn't thought of that, but it's quite a useful perspective. It's quite a useful way to reflect upon what I'm talking about. Many, many things that I try to describe when I want to explain to Westerners the sensation of absorbing and incorporating somebody else's culture, right? We don't know that experience, but perhaps I have to correct myself, because after America won its independence, there was a long time when we absorbed European ways, manners, and so on and so forth, in quite the same way that I'm talking about in the book so far as Easterners are concerned. Mm-hmm. I remember being in Japan in the late 80s when the economy was just screaming ahead, and the Japanese were quite frantically acquiring Western pieces of art, okay? There were some very famous sales of Van Gogh canvases and all that sort of thing. And we all thought it was, we correspondents all thought it was quite a phenomenon. We wrote quite a lot about it. And it was only later that I realized, you know, in the 1890s and the early decades of the 20th century, that is precisely what America did. We found ourselves affluent, and we marched over to Europe and, one might say, bought our culture. We filled our museums with acquisitions we made in Europe. It isn't that different, is it?
Talk specifically about some of the things that you're seeing in China and India and Japan in terms of the way, the specific way some of what we've been talking about is going on.
You find sort of stages, okay? You find countries, certainly one of the very basic things I want to accomplish in this book is to convey to readers some capacity for differentiating what is going on in one part of Asia or another, all right? I think what you find, for example, in China when you go for a quick visit is just this more or less frantic effort to modernize, and it's right to pattern. They are modernizing appears to mean westernizing, all right? But when you're in China for a time, you begin to recognize this underlying impulse. For example, Confucian practices are being revived, you know, and the experience of westernization at such an astonishing pace, it would be hard to overstate it, has, as many Chinese told me, has left them feeling more than a touch sort of rootless and lost amid their own modernization project. And so they're looking at the Chinese classics again. There's a Buddhist revival now and this sort of thing, right? In Japan, it is another sort of story. Their material modernization is more or less complete. I would be hard-pressed to think of a better administered country, to be honest with you. And so they are becoming more conscious of how they may proceed into the new century, but bring some Japanese-ness with them. For example, I wrote quite extensively in the book about a city called Kitakyushu. One of the great industrial centers, and all through the modernization period became a greater and greater environmental calamity. And now it is one of the greenest cities in Japan and perhaps far beyond Japan. And this reflects quite a conscious effort to combine traditional Japanese respect for nature with all of the technology they have first acquired from the West and then developed on their own. That's quite a good example of what I'm trying to get at, and that is why I gave a considerable amount of text to that community. It's a very interesting illustration, you know.
In addition to the adaptability that you're talking about, are you seeing places where there is a more extreme pushback to Western modernity that may result in a kind of conflict down the road?
You know, the psychological conflicts among Asians, which once again are matters I don't think, to make a general statement, I don't think many of us in the West appreciate terribly well. They're quite extensive, Jeff. You must understand that. I find the Chinese, as I say in the book, we look at the Chinese and we talk about production statistics and GDP, and we argue about the value of the currency and so on and so forth, okay? Beyond the 8% and 9% growth rates, you find a people in very considerable psychological turmoil. And that is what I wanted to go to. India is another kind of case. They have, to an extent, I call it China envy. You know, they're very envious of 8% and 9% growth rates in China, and India's kind of chugged along historically at a much lesser pace. But they're becoming quite conflicted as waves of what we call globalization reach their shores. They're beginning to say, well, we're growing very quickly, but what about our Indianness? You know, what about our villages as we urbanize at a quite striking pace. What is going to be happen to our hundreds and hundreds of marvelous village crafts and all that sort of thing? So conflicts arise, and they are essentially psychological to an extent. They are emotional. I suppose they have political manifestations now and again. And I wanted readers to see into this, you know, go a plane or two down from the headlines in the business section, you know, and mm-hmm. and recognize that half of humanity is doing things that we cannot comprehend simply by watching them expand their material capabilities. There's more to it than that, you know?
What, if anything, should the West be doing in trying to understand this?
Thank you for asking that. I could answer it in any number of different ways, but my impulse is to say what I tried to put across in the introduction to the book. We need to see differently, I think. That's what we could do. We need to recognize that identity, such as we imposed it for a time, this is over. This is what I mean by post-Western. I'm not talking about the decline of the West in any histrionic way. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not what I mean. We should recognize that Asians are at last grasping the validity of their own ways of being, right? And so it's going to produce hybrids of all across the board. I mean, you know, ways of thinking and so on and so forth, ways of organizing communities. Our Western notion of individuality is a very fine example. Whatever they may take from us, whatever Asians may take from us materially, our notion of individuality is simply not going to be transplanted there. It will fertilize their notions of community and so forth, that's for sure. And it will inspire individual aspiration. You can see this. But I think we ought to understand that we are not any longer going to be able to export our ideas of, for example, democracy. They are our forms of democracy, and Asians will find theirs. I believe even the Chinese will over time, although there are many pessimists on that point. I'm not among them. This sort of thing, values, institutions, you know, parliaments, they will have them, but they will not necessarily resemble ours.
I mean, I guess the other side of that is to the extent that those cultures become more confident in their own ideas.
That's a very fine word, confident.
And to the extent that they are then projected out in a more profound way, what we can learn from them.
Yes, I agree. I think the relations between East and West are in effect going to become something we might call a two-way street, okay, instead of a one-way street. And that goes to your point about growing Asian communities.
Patrick Smith, his book is Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Post-Western World. Patrick, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's a pleasure. I hope it was an interesting chat.
Thank you very much. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.